It's Tuned to Yesterday with an hour of collection curios. I'm Mark the Voner. The old-time radio collection at WRVO Public Media, known as the Ellen Robinson Memorial Library, contains tens of thousands of broadcasts on reel-to-reel tape. There's a vast archive of the big-name shows from radio's golden era, but among the shelves are series with very few surviving episodes, one-off programs, underheard tapes, and long considered to be rare broadcasts. In this hour, we get the reel spinning with programs not yet heard on our show, or at the very least, on the air in a very long time. Later in this hour, the fiery commentator John T. Flynn and Strange Adventure. But first, a Canadian series that was heard a bit past radio's proclaimed golden age, but one that marked one of many broadcasting triumphs for radio writer Norman Creighton. His on-air career started in the early 1940s, where he created what would become a radio mainstay on Canada's CBC network for about 30 years, which was interestingly embedded in an existing show called The Farm Broadcast. For a half hour at noon each day, many tuned in to hear agriculture-related news and topics, and part of it featured Creighton's 10-minute serial, The Gillens. An American radio counterpart could easily be Ma Perkins or Vic and Sade, where the story of the characters of the fictional Canadian town of Littlevale was told with a gentle touch and good-natured humor, making it appointment listening for millions. Norman Creighton would cement his place in CBC radio history with decades of approachable and ethereal radio talks dropped into the broadcast day. Now, the last episode of a 13-part series set in the Prohibition era that he wrote, called The Rum Runners, with the story The Case of the Wedding Champagne, from 1967.
The Rum Runners, a comedy series written by author Norman Creighton about the rum goings-on in Canada's maritime provinces during the bad or good old days of Prohibition, depending on how you look at it. The hero, or arch-villain of the series, again, depending on your viewpoint, is Inspector John McMulloch of the Revenue Department, whose vital task is to stamp out drinking, and the smugglers, who made a business and profit out of encouraging a wee dram at literally any cost. Now here is The Case of the Wedding Champagne with Inspector McMulloch.
If you've ever listened to the swinging ads and the singing broad acts and caught the mounting excitement as launching day approaches, then you'll know what it's like here in the little town of Shelburne on Nova Scotia's South Shore. Because this is a town with a long, proud tradition of shipbuilding. The ancestral home of Donald McKay, the man who built the Flying Cloud, the greatest clipper ship of them all. It was only natural then that back in those days of Prohibition, when we needed a new fast revenue cutter to chase the rum runners, we went to the shipyards in Shelburne. And soon, there she was, resting on the stocks, as sleek as a porpoise, waiting for the hour when she would finally slip down the ways into Shelburne Harbor. I recall that launching day very well indeed. The men were getting ready to grease the ways, and then, almost at the last minute, we discovered we'd forgotten something. Next,
Good day, Doctor. I wonder if I could get...
Yes, your name, please.
John McMullough. I'm an inspector with
John McMullough.
M-A-C? M-A-C. I'm an inspector with the Department of National Revenue.
Mm-hmm. Your age, please.
That doesn't really matter, Doctor. I just want to get...
Yes, now, what are the symptoms?
Well, all I want is to ask if you could give me a...
Open your mouth.
Well, all I want is a...
A little wider, please. That's it. Yes, your tonsils should be tended to now. Let me look in your ear.
Doctor, please, just let me...
Wax. It needs to be syringed. Can you hear me?
I hear you perfectly. I wish you could hear me.
I'm listening, my good man. Now, come now. What's wrong with you? I haven't all day to wait.
I came in here to ask you if you would give me a prescription for a bottle of champagne.
A bottle of champagne?
We're launching a revenue cutter down at the shipyards. We can't do it until we have a bottle of champagne. And as both you and I know, there's only one legal way to secure liquor nowadays, with a doctor's prescription at the drugstore.
Yes, yes.
So if you'd be so good as to make out a prescription for a bottle of champagne...
Oh, no. I'm afraid, sir, the Hippocratic Oath does not allow me to prescribe for ships.
Now, just a minute.
I'm a physician, sir, not a boat hook.
Now, look here, doctor. I've got to have a bottle of champagne. Ottawa is waiting for this boat to be launched and on the job. We need something fast enough to overtake the rum runners.
Well, until you do overtake them, I don't know where you'll get a bottle of champagne. Not here in Shelburne. I can't even get a decent bottle myself. There's only one bottle that I know of in town, a patient of mine, and she wouldn't let you have it to launch the entire Canadian Navy.
Who's that?
Well, I've offered her a free tonsillectomy, a post-nasal irrigation. I've even offered to pull out all her teeth. She won't budge.
Won't let you have it?
No.
Is she so very wealthy?
Oh, no. A quite unimportant little person. You'd pass her on the street any day and not give her a second glance. She does dressmaking, hemming skirts, repairing buttonholes, you know, that sort of thing.
Oh.
Very refined, mind you, but quite undistinguished. You'd hardly notice her.
But she has a bottle of champagne.
Yes. 1912. One of the really fine vintage years.
And her name?
Miss Desbrise. Miss Winnie Desbrise.
And where shall I find Miss Desbrise?
Oh, you'll find her, I expect, bending over her sewing machine, hemming someone's skirt, immersed in a drab little colorless existence. Tell her I'll give her a free appendectomy, complete with the very latest in suturing, the double button, and figure of eight stitch. If she'll just let me get my hands on that bottle of champagne.
Then your answer is still...
I'm afraid it's still no. No, Inspector, I couldn't let you have it. That bottle of champagne means too much to me. I bought it some years ago at a time when I thought I was going to be married.
Oh, I see.
Now, how am I going to hemstitch this cuff?
Well, Miss Desbrise, I don't suppose there's much use in offering you any money. Where this bottle has such tender associations for you. I know how people like to hold on to things like that.
Now, the facing around this collar. Let's see now.
I do hope I haven't said anything to disturb you.
No.
I quite realize how very personal this matter is to you, Miss Desbrise. I don't wish to awaken memories of a broken romance, but it really is of the greatest urgency that we get that ship launched today. Ottawa's been in touch with me by telephone.
I didn't say my romance was broken, Inspector McMulloch.
Oh?
We're still going together.
Oh, well, then.
Only we just haven't got married.
I see.
Well, after Carl got through his pharmacy course, well, I sort of helped him to get through. He didn't have much money. Well, that's why I took to dressmaking. Well, after he graduated and took a job at the drugstore, we were going to get married, but... Somehow, I don't know. It's just been one thing after another, and we've kept putting it off. I think I'll just tap
you,
the edge here.
You do a good deal of dressmaking?
Oh, and it's all I do all the time. Better
I suppose
facing.
You make all your own clothes,
what? Make my own clothes? A dressmaker never makes her own clothes. Why, she's like the cobbler's children. Their shoes are always in the worst shape than anybody's.
Oh, but I think that dress you're wearing is very attractive.
This thing? Oh, Inspector McMullen, midi blouses aren't in fashion. Nobody wears midi blouses anymore. Or midi skirts. Except those who can't afford to buy new things and have to accept hand-me-downs from their relatives.
Oh, I didn't mean to suggest
quite
that...
All right. I've given up trying to be stylish. I just like to read about them, you know, in the big American magazines like the Delineator and the Pictorial Review. They show pictures of all the latest models. Oh, yes, really, I absolutely adore looking at those American magazines. It's so terribly exciting what's happening today in clothes and... Well, just about everything. It's all in such a ferment, isn't it? I was reading last week in this serial. I'm reading a McClure's magazine. And the heroine, mind you, she smoked cigarettes.
Cigarettes?
I knew some women did, but they're writing about it nowadays, right out in print.
Oh, times are changing.
Yes.
Why don't you make some of those new clothes for yourself?
Well, I shouldn't tell you this, but I did make an outfit for myself, but I've never had the nerve to wear it.
Huh?
Well, Shelburne is very conservative, you know. An old loyalist town with the old public wells and all the old traditions. Well, folks around here don't take kindly to things that are too up to date.
Well... Give them something to talk about for a change.
This outfit I was telling you about, I don't know what they'd say.
I can see you there, Miss Desbrise, on the launching platform, surrounded by officials, photographers snapping pictures, and you getting ready to swing that bottle of champagne.
You mean you want me to be up there but holding...
Yes.
You want me?
Of course.
Oh, Mr. McMullock, I mean Inspector, I mean... You really want me to officiate the ceremony?
We would all be utterly charmed, Miss Desbrise.
What'll I wear?
Well, how about that wonderful new outfit you made for yourself?
Oh, but I wouldn't dare. Oh, this is all so sudden. Me, up there on the launching platform. Will there be many people there?
The shipyard will be jammed.
Oh, I'd love to show them that I have something to wear besides someone's old cast-offs. Will my picture be in the Toronto papers?
Wouldn't be a bit surprised.
Oh. Winnipeg papers?
Could be.
Boston?
Possibly.
Aunt Olive out in Winnipeg and all those big old floppy hats she keeps sending me. And Aunt Em up in Toronto. This is her midi blouse. And Aunt Mattie up in Boston. And her old high button boots. I just like them to know that down here in Shelburne we keep up with the times, too. Oh, and that beaded crepe de chine is all the rage.
That's
I can hardly wait to wait. Oh, Inspector! Inspector! I'll do it.
Good for you. You'll remember to bring the champagne.
Oh, well, yes, I'll pick it up at the drugstore.
You have it at the drugstore.
Oh, Carl, my friend, you know, he's the clerk there. Well, he's been taking care of it for me.
Oh. Well... You go to the drugstore and pick up the champagne, and I'll meet you there.
Oh, dear. This is so exciting. I feel almost as if I were a bride.
Orange, strawberry, or sarsaparilla?
Sarsaparilla, please.
Sarsaparilla. Excuse me, please. I see someone waiting at the pharmacy counter. Just to help yourself to a straw.
Yes,
What is it, miss? Something I can... Winnie.
Hello, Carl.
Winnie.
Lovely day.
It's you.
Were you expecting someone else?
I didn't recognize... For heaven's sakes, what's going on?
This is launching day, didn't you know?
Well, yes, but nobody gets dressed up like that on launching day.
Oh, maybe you're not keeping up with the times, dear.
All those beads. And can't you button yourself up any higher?
There are no buttons, dear.
No buttons? Oh, gosh, Winnie, here... Here's this newspaper. Oh, wait. Wait till I get some corn plasters. Perhaps I could... Suppose a customer should walk in.
Well, aren't I a customer?
Winnie, I'm just thinking for your own good. Well, you don't want people staring at you.
I don't know. It might be rather pleasant to have people staring at me for a change.
Here, I'll get you one of my white dusters to put
I
on.
I don't want one of your old white dusters.
But you can't just go around looking like that.
Can't I?
Well, now, Winnie, be reasonable. I don't know what's got into you.
You know, Carl, I'm starting to get my eyes opened.
Well, don't start getting other people's eyes opened while you're about it.
When you put on a crepe de chine afternoon frock in vermilion and silver with a beaded binding, the whole world just seems to come alive.
I have a reputation to keep up. This is an ethical drugstore. I can't allow folks to get the idea that you're not
the mousy little person you appear to be when you stand behind the counter selling cough drops, huh?
Now, wait a minute.
If you had any gumption, Carl, we'd have been married years ago. You're just too downright scared.
You don't have to make a scene.
Well, other girls are wearing cross-stitch embroidery. Why shouldn't I?
There's such a thing as going too far, you know.
Carl, I would like that bottle of champagne.
Oh, now, let's not get into an argument.
My champagne, please.
Well, I didn't mean to imply that... Well, I think your dress is quite striking as far as the dress goes. Trouble is, it doesn't go very far, does it? Did you make it yourself? I have nothing against the dress, exactly.
Now,
Winnie.
If you hadn't gone and opened it.
Very well. If you insist.
You can bring it over to one of the ice cream tables. I think I'll sit down for a minute.
Pardon me, miss. Might I join you at this table?
Oh, well, I there are other tables.
None with quite the charms of this one. Belong here in Shelburne?
Oh, yes.
Well, allow me to compliment you on your good taste in clothes.
Oh, thank you.
Haven't seen anything quite so revealing since the last time I was in Paris.
Oh, you go to Paris often?
Well, not so much Paris. I find Saint-Pierre a little easier to get to.
Saint-Pierre?
Mm-hmm. And the quality of their product is very fine. Especially in the cask. We handle a good deal of it in bulk, you know.
In casks? Oh, you mean liquor?
Their brandy is superb.
Winnie, I wish you wouldn't do this. Now, please, come to your senses.
I beg your pardon.
I wrap the champagne in this paper bag.
Just set it down, please.
Now, Winnie, remember, this is ours.
Ah, bottle of champagne. Well.
Winnie, don't take it out of the bag, for goodness sake. Someone might see.
I think I'll have a package of cigarettes, if you don't mind.
Cigarettes?
You heard me.
Cigarettes?
The lady would like a package of cigarettes.
You mean cubebs?
I do not mean cubebs. I mean cigarettes.
I'll get them for you, my dear.
Thank you.
This bumpkin doesn't seem to understand.
Listen, what's the big idea?
Now, I wonder if I remember to bring my cigarette holder.
But you don't smoke.
Oh, yes, here it is.
What are those things on your wrist?
These are slave bangles.
Slave bangles?
I'm wearing one on my ankle, too.
Don't draw attention to it.
They're the last word in jewelry down in New York.
Winnie, I don't understand you. I just don't understand
that's
you.
That's been obvious for some time.
Smoking. Here, in public. You wouldn't know how to smoke.
There we are, my dear. Package of Turkish cigarettes with a picture of that harem girl on the cover in décolleté. Left some change on the counter. You may leave us now.
But you can't.
Private Verena, please.
Oh, yes, coming, sir, coming.
I see you have one of those extra long cigarette holders. Very fashionable.
Now, how does it fit on?
Oh, here, allow me. I think these ovals will fit. There.
Thank you.
Now for a light. This reminds me of the gay cabarets down in Saint-Pierre. Soft lights, fragrance of a cigarette. Shall we open the champagne?
No, I couldn't do that. Anyway, it's not legal to drink.
Such disarming simplicity, not legal. Would that really stop you from opening the bottle?
Well, I don't think it would be quite the place to...
Oh, come now, my dear. You're obviously a woman of some sophistication. I'll just take it out of the bag and loosen the wire.
Just a minute, huh? Charlie. Not so fast.
You?
Yes.
God. Oh.
And just in time, by the look of it.
Always spoiling things.
Yes. The law keeps catching up with you, doesn't it?
What are you doing here?
Making sure that you don't open that bottle of champagne. Oh. Now, give it to me.
Inspector, he doesn't mean any harm.
You see, now I'm innocent. The lady says so.
This man happens to be a rum runner. Hand it over. Miss Desbrise. I think it's time we went along to the shipyard.
Oh, yes, the shipyard.
Now, hold on, Inspector. I haven't even got round to ordering ice cream. And why should she want to go to the shipyards with you, I'd like to know?
Charlie, I suggest you come along and find out. Then we can both accompany Miss Desbrise down to the docks.
Oh, my goodness. Now, let me see. I have my cigarette, my champagne, and a man on either arm.
Be nervous now.
Oh, everyone's looking at me.
Steady now.
Oh,
steady.
Oh,
I... Remember, you're doing a fine service for your country. With this new cover, we'll be able to run our friend Charlie here out of business.
I don't know why I ever allowed you to drag me down here to see this tablon.
Victor, I don't think I can go through with it.
Yes, you can.
No, I... Really...
Chin up now. Hold on to the champagne.
Oh, yes.
And let's see you flourish that cigarette holder.
Yeah.
The photographers are beginning to aim the cameras.
Oh, dear, pictures.
Allow me, my dear. Pray take my arm I'll escort you up these steps.
Oh, dear, yes.
Onto the platform.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Charlie.
Can't stand by when a lady is in distress. Even though my own livelihood's in jeopardy.
Good of you.
There. Mounted to the podium.
Charlie, if you don't mind, I think you'd better leave us now.
Leave?
This is hardly the place for you to be standing. Now, kindly go below and join the spectacle.
No, Inspector, don't tell him to go away. I need all the moral support I can get.
Moral support? From him?
I'll hold your arm, my dear.
Thank you. Are they taking pictures now? Am I holding my cigarette holder at the right angle? Perhaps I should take a puff. Oh, look. There's no cigarette in my holder. What happened to my cigarette?
Hey, what's this?
Oh, my. Look at all the smoke.
The wood shavings are on fire.
Your cigarette must have fallen down among the chips.
Oh, mercy.
Shavings.
Look, for heaven's sake.
Water, someone.
Oh,
Get some water!
Burn the boat up, do you?
Have no fear, my dear. Charlie is at your side. I have here in my hip pocket a 26-ounce bottle of rum.
Rum?
Rum?
Oh. Well, go on and use it. Rum will do. Get down there and put out the fire.
Oh, it seems a sinful use for this good Demerara rum.
Oh, but
for you, my dear, I would give up even this.
Why, I hope he gets it out.
Look. Pour it over that piece of oakum, Charlie. That's where it started.
I think he's getting it under control now.
Oh, here comes some men with shovels.
Thank goodness.
Oh, it's all right now. The danger's over.
Oh, my goodness. I thought I wasn't going to get to launch the ship after all.
Well, we've got to give Charlie credit. That was a pretty fine thing to do, really.
Oh, it's under control now. Don't worry, my dear.
Thank you so much.
That was mighty big of you, Charlie.
Really?
Mighty big.
Now, can I stay on the platform?
Well, I can very well refuse you.
Inspector, look, Inspector, the man is giving you the signal. I think they're ready about to start the launching.
Mm-hmm. Are you ready?
What do I do?
Well, just take the bottle of champagne.
Yes.
And give it a good swing.
Yes.
And before you let go, say, I hereby christen this ship Winnie the First.
Winnie? Oh, you're not naming her after me.
Indeed we are, Miss Brise.
Oh.
We couldn't launch her without your cooperation.
Oh.
Now, ready with your pictures?
Oh, dear, I'm so nervous.
Now, take a good swing on that bottle. Go on.
I hereby christen this ship Winnie the First.
Very good.
Well done, Miss Brise. Well done.
Winnie, you haven't launched
her. Oh, Carl, did you see me smash the champagne bottle?
That wasn't champagne. I gave you the wrong bottle.
Not champagne.
I gave you Dr. Witherspoon's nerve tonic by mistake.
Oh, dear. Inspector, we used the wrong bottle.
Too late.
Oh, look.
Too late now. She's beginning to move.
Oh. There she goes.
What about the champagne?
I still have it at the drugstore, and I bought a marriage license on the way down.
Oh.
So we can still make use of it.
Oh, we're really going to get married?
This time, I wouldn't dare let you get away. Not in that outfit you're wearing.
Oh, I'm so happy.
May we come to the wedding?
Oh, but of course, yes.
Charlie, what? In view of what you did to save this ship, I think you should officiate. As one of the ushers.
Oh.
How about it, Miss Daybreeze?
Oh, but I'd love it.
Well, this isn't exactly what I had in mind.
Oh, you can open the champagne.
Well, as long as it's not Dr. Witherspoon's nerve tonic, I'll be there.
And so, with the champagne bottle popping happily, we conclude our final encounter with the rum runners. Yeah.
That was the case of the wedding champagne. The final episode in the comedy series, The Rum Runners, written by Norman Creighton. Inspector McCulloch was played by Bill Fulton. Winnie by Faith Ward, Carl by David Brown, Charlie by J. Clyde Douglas, and the Doctor by Bruce Armstrong. The musical score was arranged and conducted by David Woods. The Rum Runners comedy series was directed for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation by Peter Duncan and produced by Alan Yates of the CBC International Service in Montreal.
The Rum Runners on Tuned to Yesterday, a CBC broadcast from 1967. You're listening to an hour of collection curios on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm Mark Livonier. Next off the shelf, something that's very striking to the ear from the lightning rod that was radio commentator and author John T. Flynn. Through his column in the progressive New Republic magazine, he was a contrarian voice through the presidency of FDR, as he was disillusioned by the promise of the New Deal of the 1930s and American interventionism overseas, being a distinct voice in the pre-war America First Committee, and often spoke at their rallies of thousands, several broadcasts on Mutual Radio, in fact, featuring aviator Charles Lindbergh, who was a celebrity figurehead in the group that, among other things, rejected socialism and in the early 1940s were aggressively against U.S. involvement in the conflict overseas. That is, until the group disbanded just days after America's entrance into World War II to support the country's efforts against a global threat. As the years went on, Flynn's lacerating social opinions never let up, and in 1953, through America's Future Incorporated syndication, he released hundreds of commentaries for broadcast. Here's one now called The War on Schools.
I want to talk to you today about something which I am sure is very close to your minds and your hearts as Americans. You have heard, I am sure, of what might be called the war in the schools. I refer to the war between those who want to use the schools to indoctrinate the children with socialist ideas and those who are opposed to that. I have tried to tell this story in an article which I wrote for the Reader's Digest and which appears in the current issue of the Digest. It is called Who Owns Your Child's Mind? Now, one thing we're all sure about, and that is that the state does not own the child's mind. Neither your mind, nor your child's mind, nor anybody's mind. That is the Russian system. The function of education in our public schools is to train the child to use his mind, to give him information, to train him to think, and to inculcate in him those principles of moral conduct which are the accepted code of our society. Now, do you think a teacher has a right to use the classroom to change the religion of the child, the public classroom, or to make them all into Catholics or Protestants or Christian Scientists? Such a teacher would be promptly dismissed. Do you think she has a right to use the classroom to make them into communists, or fascists, or socialists, or to teach them that our system of government and our constitution are wrong and must be changed to be more like those in socialist England? Now, if a teacher does not have a right to do this, do you think a dozen teachers in a school have a right to gang up quietly and do it? To sneak socialism over on the pupils? Of course not. Now, I make this charge, and I do it deliberately, knowing full well all the facts relating to it. I charge that a group of teachers, very important in the teaching profession, many of them high up in the councils of the national teacher organizations, have been carrying on a conspiracy for a number of years to use our public schools for the purpose of indoctrinating the students in the principles of socialism. I do not mean they have succeeded in all or even in most of our schools. I do say they have succeeded in many, and maybe in your own town. I do not know. Now let me tell you what they did and how they did it. One of the leaders in this whole left-wing educational group is a gentleman named Dr. George S. Counts, a professor of education at Teachers College in Columbia University. He is a distinguished educator and is entitled to his opinions. Away back in 1932, he wrote a book called Dare the Schools Build a New Social Order. In that, he said that we are in an era which has shifted away from considerations affecting human liberty and to considerations which have to do with the production and distribution and consumption of wealth. In other words, the important thing now is the distribution of wealth and not human liberty. And then he declared that our capitalist system no longer works, that there is no longer a choice between individualism and collectivism, that is, between our system and socialism. The choice is between two forms of collectivism, one democratic and the other feudal. Then he says plainly that the society of the future, and I quote him, is to be a planned, coordinated, and socialized economy. Now, that's plain enough, isn't it? How are we going to do this, he asks. We must do it, he answers, through the schools. Dr. Count says that, quote, the teachers should deliberately reach for power, these are his words, and then make the most of their conquest. He says they must shape the social ideals and behavior of the coming generation, and they must shape it in the direction of collectivism or socialism. Now you will say, after all, this is just one man's opinion, but he did not stop there. He and some other educators got a grant of $300,000 from the Carnegie Foundation to make a study of the schools. They brought this study out in 17 volumes. And the final volume had its conclusion. And that is, and stated in very plain language that no man can misunderstand, that is, and I read it to you exactly as they put it, the age of individualism is closing, and the new age of collectivism is emerging. And then the report says that the teachers must go to work on the minds of the pupils to prepare them for the new collectivist society. And this report was brought out under the auspices of the American Historical Association and paid for by the Carnegie Foundation. And Harold Laski, one of the leaders of the British Socialist Party in England, read this study and said he hailed it as a report of an educational plan for a socialist America. It is a direct criticism of the ideas that have shaped American capitalism. That's what he said. Now, I have given you their own words, and these people are not unimportant people. But they did not rest here, and I'll tell you what they did. Now, how do you reach the mind of a child in the public schools? You reach them through the textbooks and through the teachers. Therefore, the first thing they did was to get the textbooks slanted in the direction of collectivism. They do not call it communism or socialism. They're too slick for that. They sneak it into the child's mind with prettier words. Of course, they didn't get all the textbooks, but they got plenty. Now, the next thing they set out to do was to get into the schools of education where teachers are made. They have gotten into some of the greater schools of education, and to whatever extent they have been able to influence these schools, they have been turning out socialist teachers by the thousands. Now, if a citizen finds this sort of thing in his school and criticizes it, he is denounced by these birds as an enemy of public education. Of course, the real enemies of public education are this gang that is trying to sneak socialism into our public schools. They are the enemies of the schools. Now, let me call your attention to another magazine article printed in McCall's magazine and written by a gentleman who was at one time a commentator on the air for the extreme left-wing organ, The Nation. The article is entitled, Who is Trying to Ruin Our Schools? Of course, his conclusion is that those who are trying to knock this thing out of the schools are the real enemies. And the principal purpose of this article is to destroy the reputation of a brave and patriotic American woman who has been trying to combat this European collectivism in our American schools, Mrs. Lucille Carden Crane. The article uses the well-known smear technique. Its purpose is to discredit Mrs. Crane. The article picks out two other people, Alan Zoll, branded as a former Hitlerite, and the other, General Amos A. Freeze, who mixes up in his propaganda an anti-Catholic motive. These two men head two other organizations. Now, Zoll on one side is discredited as pro-Hitler, and Freeze, on the other side, is discredited as anti-Catholic. And then Mrs. Crane is artfully put in between these two in a kind of a squeeze play to smear her with the odium which the writer attaches to Zoll and Freeze. But Mrs. Crane is the real target, and the whole article is written in such a way, so far as she is concerned, to make her seem like a crackpot. I know Mrs. Crane. She is an able, judicious, brave American woman. And this article on her is one of the shabbiest things I have ever seen in a magazine with the assumed reputation of McCall's. This is a strange cause for McCall's magazine to support. Now let me tell you what Mrs. Crane does. She brought into existence an organization called the Educational Reviewer. Its only purpose is to study and review textbooks to determine whether or not they are slanted in the direction of socialism. Books are referred to professional educators to study, and the reviews are available to anybody who wishes to get them. Now let me tell you how this organization came into being. A businessman sent his daughter through a leading women's college. Being a top student, she won a scholarship to a famous British school, the London School of Economics. Not knowing anything about it, the parents sent her there. And she returned in 2 years a confirmed socialist. Of course she did. That school is the official educational institution of the British Fabian Socialist Party. Its purpose is to make socialists for the British Labour Party. The parents wondered why an American college steered their daughter into a British socialist school. Her father wondered if there was anything like that in his community. He had the local high school textbooks, therefore, studied and was amazed at what he found. And so, to help other parents, he and some other gentlemen joined in forming what they call the Educational Reviewer, and they induced Mrs. Crane to give up her work and take over the direction of this. Now, this highly intelligent and orderly institution has hit these sneak socialists a very hard blow, and they have set out to discredit and liquidate Mrs. Crane and the Educational Reviewer, and McCall's magazine lends itself to the attack. Now, there's plenty more to this story. I intend to tell you more about it. I will introduce you to some of these textbooks and to some of the curious people who have been writing them. I will tell you how to go about getting the facts straight about the schools in your town. Remember, they do not teach socialism. They do not teach communism. They do not teach these things by these names. The scheme is first to break down the child's faith in our form of government, and then to sell him a half dozen ideas, which, when all are put together, amount to socialism, but the child is too young and innocent to know it. Now, you will see this more plainly when I introduce you in subsequent broadcasts to some of the textbooks which I am talking about.
John T. Flynn, in a syndicated episode from 1953. Flynn actually employed a second building at his home as a broadcast studio where he did most of his radio work. Now, the last tape of this hour of Collection Curios on Tuned to Yesterday reveals a short-lived series that was probably inconsistently heard on the air during its syndicated release in 1945, as Strange Adventure was offered to basically drop in when stations had some time in between programs and offered a couple of brief pauses for local commercials. Radio actor Pat McGeehan, best known for his future role as an announcer who got in on the action on Red Skelton's wildly popular comedy series, told unusual tales in brief broadcasts that were either charming or curious, and stations had a lot to choose from, as the series produced well over 250 episodes. Here's one now called The Legend of the Bells.
Strange Adventure.
It's a long ride across the Arizona desert from Nogales to Tucson. More than my Mexican companion Felipe and I cared to undertake without a night's rest. It was almost dark when we camped near the ruins of the old mission of Guavave.
That is the haunted mission, senor. It is said that the spirits of the departed padres and Indians come to this place for prayer and meditation, just as they did so many years ago.
I left Felipe to finish supper and wandered into the ruins. Hardly had I stepped inside than I heard the peal of bells. I stood still, wondering. Had I in my thoughts about the mission projected myself to the days when the place was new, when the bells summoned the faithful to prayer? Suddenly I heard a soft voice and looked up. Standing near the altar was the robed figure of a Jesuit priest.
So, my son, you have heard the silver bells of Mission Guavavi, is that not so?
I was too dumbfounded to speak. The good priest continued.
Since the mission was built in 1691, many people have heard the bells. I will tell you the legend. When the mission was built, there were no bells of any kind. The padres sent the Indians out to search for metal ore. They came back with great loads of ore that contained copper and silver. A crude smelter and mold were built, and soon the clear tones of the silver bells rang out over the desert. The people loved the bells they had wrought and were happy for a time. Then the Pima Indians revolted against the cruelty of the Spaniards, and a wave of terror swept across the desert. A wild, savage army murdered and plundered at Caborca and San Xavier. Then they marched here toward Guavavi. Down from the hills came the charging warriors, mad with bloodlust. Everything seemed lost to the few defenders of the mission. As arrows rained into the mission, a small Indian boy, wounded and bleeding, crawled to the bell rope. As he drew himself up, the bells began to ring. The savages stopped fighting and looked with awe toward the bell tower. Most of them had heard the bells before and remembered the kindly mission fathers who had been so good to them. The attackers rode away, and the mission was saved by a small boy and the silver bells. Do you still wonder, my son, why you heard the bells?
Yes, Father, I do.
Padre Francisco said this in his prayer. May only the pure in heart be privileged to hear the sacred bells of Guavavi.
And then, as suddenly as the figure of the priest had appeared, it was gone, and I left the mission feeling a bit shaky. Then I heard a quite familiar voice calling to me.
Hey, senor, where you are? The supper, she's fixed.
This is Pat McGinn in Hollywood, California, saying goodbye from my writer, Charles Crowder, and inviting you to listen to Thunder Canyon, our next tale of
Strange Adventure.
Strange Adventure, delivering short stories from 1945, and we do have time for another one from a couple of episodes later called The Escape Artist.
Strange Adventure.
The eerie wail of the siren sounded through the early morning mist, proclaiming that a prisoner had escaped from behind the grim gray wall of Dartmoor Prison. Inside England's most famous penitentiary, orders were snapped out as guards were called and armed for the chase. In the prison office, the warden stood beside a teletype operator, dictating a message to the British Central Police Headquarters.
Dartmoor Prison, 653, Stanley Thurston, successfully escaped at approximately 6 a.m. Search getting underway.
The operator finished the message, then looked up from the type sheet.
Stan Thurston, warden, isn't that the chap who boasted that no prison in the world could hold him? Yes, Kyles. And since then he's given Clemsford, Lewes, and Liverpool the slip. Now he has reached the top. He's cracked Dartmoor.
Everything had gone right so far for the escaped prisoner. He had picked the locks of his cell with uncanny skill and slipped unobserved down the long, dimly lighted corridor to the rear door. Once in the prison yard, he had taken a sandbag from a stack piled against the wall, tied a rope to it, and thrown it over the wall to act as a counterweight. It was a matter of seconds before he had scaled the wall, his actions hidden by the morning mist. Stanley Thurston, the notorious thief and confidence man, was afraid for the first time in his checkered career. He knew the men of the searching party would shoot him on sight. By now they would be opening the gates, surging out to run him down like a wild animal. He cast a quick glance toward the prison. His pursuers were not in sight, but rounding a turn in the road, he saw the group of men he had been waiting for. Each morning he had watched these men from his cell window and formulated this part of his escape plan. The men were almost abreast now, dressed in white shorts and undershirts. They were members of a cross-country racing team out for their daily training run. Quickly, Thurston removed his heavy prison trousers and shirt. As the men galloped past, the escaped prisoner dashed out onto the road and fell in behind them, his trim athletic figure unnoticed among the scantily clad runners. He was sprinting to freedom. Or so he thought. As Thurston trotted along behind the cross-country runners, he could hear the sound of his pursuers getting nearer. His athletic companions left the road and set out across an open field. There was nothing for Thurston to do but follow.
The runners came to a sudden stop near the edge of town. Before Thurston had time to dart for cover, one of the men saw him.
Oh, I say, we have a new member with us this morning. Have you been with us all the while?
It's almost. You see, I live on a farm some distance back, and I've always admired you chaps the way you run. So this morning I thought I'd see if I could keep up with you. I do hope you don't mind.
Oh, certainly not. We're student guards in training at Dartmoor Prison. Come inside while I phone the warden. I'm sure he'd be glad to offer a position to a young chap of your strength and great athletic ability.
This is Pat McGeehan in Hollywood, California, saying goodbye from my writer, Charles Cratter, and inviting you to listen to The Doubles Diary, our next tale of
Strange Adventure.
Strange Adventure, on Tuned to Yesterday, an episode from 1945 from Telaway Syndication, who also produced the series Strange Wills. And back to the shelf it goes. This has been an hour of Collection Curios on Tuned to Yesterday. Be with us again for more rare and unique programs from radio's golden age. I'm Mark Livonier. Thanks for listening.